This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I am Meera Sivasodhi. In the studio with me, Dr. Vaishnavi Jayasingam. She's a consultant clinical oncologist from Subangjaya Medical Center. And today we're going to be discussing life-changing advancements in cancer care. Now, we all know that cancer care has come a long way. There's been greater awareness about the importance of early detection. We now have better screening technology and we have advanced imaging techniques. We have innovative new therapies for cancer. So Dr. Vaishnavi is going to help us understand how her work as an oncologist has changed over time, given all these developments. And you know what? Developments to come. I mean, there's so much still in the pipeline that we can actually work on and benefit the people. However, there's going to be one interesting conversation, or rather question I'm going to ask Dr. Vaishnavi, is that we do know from the ASEAN Costs in Oncology Action Study, 48% of patients experience financial catastrophe 12 months after a cancer diagnosis. So how do we then balance this financial burden faced by patients versus all these wonderful developments that are coming out in the area of cancer care? So if you have a question for us, give us a call. It's 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Vaishnavi. How are you today?
Thank you very much. I must say a big thank you for having me today.
Anytime. You know, I want to just talk to you about your journey as an oncologist and how you have, what you have experienced in terms of developments in the whole area of cancer care as an oncologist. I mean, we've seen developments in diagnostic methods, we've seen developments in drugs, in local therapy options, in fertilization preservations, in implants, in palliative care. So much is happening. You know, it's not just about treatment as such. What have you seen and you know, how has that come along for you?
Yeah, I think I must say that in the field of oncology, very often there's a lot of emphasis given on the actual treatment of cancer. But looking at the whole picture, I think I would say that there's many, many aspects in the care of patients with cancer, which I think makes a very big difference in their outcome. So although there's been a lot of emphasis in advancements in treatment per se, I think the advancements that have happened with regards to screening, as well as awareness in general population, with regards to recognizing early symptoms of cancer, as well as acting upon it and taking things seriously to a level that you would want some form of intervention or even diagnosis to be made. Because I think I must say that in our culture, it is somewhat, there is actually a big difference among how patients present. Patients with a better socioeconomic background tend to present earlier. So that kind of difference is actually quite obvious in the center where you work, where if your catchment area of patients are from an area where the background socioeconomically and education level is actually much better, that they tend to present with disease at a very much earlier stage. The reason for that would likely be that the awareness is better, they understand what is going on, the medical seeking behavior is actually better. So I think the advancements that we have seen in the last multiple decades, especially in our country, is with regards to awareness, which has really improved at every level in the urban areas as well as in the outskirts. We do see the government doing a lot in trying to improve screening methods. Although in our country, it's not to a level where screening for cancers is in the national health policy. You would know that in overseas countries, things like mammograms for breast cancers, pap smears for cervical cancers, a lot of cancers like prostate cancers, which are actually in the national health policies, whereby all average citizens will get this form of screening for free, in fact. It does not apply in our country as yet, but I think a lot of things have been done to a level that we have seen a significant difference. And I think in a daily practice, nowadays to see patients presenting at an earlier stage seems more likely compared to what it was 10 to 15 years ago.
Okay, so we are moving in the right direction. However, you know, based on the government screening you know, issue that you spoke about just now, the government does allocate funds for mammograms and pap smears at a very minimal cost. I think pap smears are like ₱1 or something like that at the LPPKN you know, outlets. However, the take-up rate is extremely low. Now, that says a lot about the Malaysian You know, and I'm only talking about these two aspects, right? What can we do to ensure that there is a higher take-up? Does that mean awareness is still dismal?
I would say that awareness is, I think, a bit disproportionate with regards to the standard of living as well as the socioeconomic background. For instance, what LPPKN is trying to do in reaching out to this population. So we even have got mobile mammogram vans as well as pap smears, which are virtually going to the outskirts. Yeah. Although the penetration of this is not to say at a maximum level, but there is definitely intense effort in this line. But what we do notice is that sometimes patients who are afraid of being diagnosed, and very often, even if they've already noted some symptoms, this behavior of wanting to be in denial and, you know, just putting it aside. And also, of course, we do notice that in patients who are of a socioeconomic background, which is not as good, where their emphasis is, of course, putting food on the table, a diagnosis of cancer is not only about the disease of the person who is affected, but if they lose their livelihood or not are in a position to go to work, or just because they have to go for multiple hospital appointments and treatment, that's going to cause a very significant impact in terms of their earning ability as well as their salaries and how their whole family copes. So we tend to see that happening with patients where they tend to postpone treatment or, you know, keep it for a later date. Whereas in patients who are a bit more well off, you know, the attention, I mean, the medical seeking behavior is actually very different. You would see patients who, even if they do not get that opportunity for a free screening, they would take up paying for it and going all out to do all these health screening things. The thing that I would just like to point out is that when it comes to health screening with regards to cancer, I do know of many people who sometimes say, I go for my yearly health checkups, but I didn't know that I had this going on. And how come is it that this health screen program package, so-called, did not detect my cancer?
Yes.
So I think the point to note is that, of course, there are several cancers which can be diagnosed from screening, like pap smears for cervical cancers, mammograms, colonoscopies for patients with symptoms. But having a clear check at the end of a health screening does not rule it out completely, but definitely it increases the chances of having diagnosis done at an earlier stage, although it may not be for all cancers per se.
Okay. And most Malaysians present at later stage because of that, isn't it, Dr. Vaishnavi?
On average, the majority of the patients we see are actually at stage 3 and 4 of cancers. The reasons might be also because sometimes at an early stage, the symptoms can be a little subtle. For instance, with renal cancers and ovarian cancers, where these tumours are rather deep-seated. So at its early stages, patients are actually very well. They're still functioning. They're going to work. They are, you know, doing their everyday life just like normal. By the time symptoms tend to appear in these kind of deep-seated tumours, it's usually quite late. And I think it wouldn't be, I think, the fault of the patient in any way because they're relatively well.
Yeah.
And by the time they get diagnosed, and that's where you hear these patients who sometimes tell that everything was perfectly fine until a few weeks prior to everything being diagnosed and coming out. Yeah.
But having said that, even breast cancer patients are presenting late.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And I think that is one cancer. I get so upset because that's stage one. It's what, 85% treatable or
maybe even higher, actually,
yes,
in this day and age.
Exactly, right?
Yes.
But there is still that stigma about coming forward, even if you feel something.
Definitely. I think, and the thing is that sometimes we even see patients who are very educated, actually, you know, who are professionals even, who sometimes...
Informed.
Of course. Yeah. So they are very much aware of what this likely could be. And sometimes they've even been diagnosed. We do see even very affluent patients who seek traditional treatment and supplements and other alternative therapies. It's not to say that traditional treatment and supplements are detrimental, but in the context of cancer and treatment, I think people need to be aware that they need to be very careful and not to be misled, especially by sometimes things that they see on the internet or, you know, by word of mouth or even some treatment approaches which are not really tested, where outcomes are questionable, but they tend to get carried away because they claim that outcomes are good or toxicity is low and somehow get misled in that way.
I suppose in the context of cancer, there's you can try it if that's something that you want to try. But I think what's not on your side when you go down that path is you lose time.
Yes, and time is a big major factor. Yeah. So that's where if you present earlier and you get diagnosed at an earlier stage, naturally these patients would do better, irrespective of what treatment they've had. Having cancer diagnosed at an earlier stage is, I think, one of the best indicators of outcome in the long run. And that's why we also see the government that realizes that if we diagnose patients earlier, we are going to be spending much less on treatment. Patients are going to do far better. Their quality of life is going to be definitely better in the long run. And hopefully they are around longer for their families and to spend more time with everyone.
Okay. Dr. Vaishnavi Jayasingam in the studio with me, consultant clinical oncologist from Subangjaya Medical Center. If you have a question for her, it's the number to call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Zaidi is asking, I recently had colitis, but my general surgeon did a biopsy and it's not cancerous, but I was advised to undergo a colonoscopy 1 year from now. Should I be worried? Is this the first signs of colorectal cancer?
So colitis mainly means that there is some form of inflammation going on in the bowel. Inflammation in the bowel can be due to multiple reasons. Common things are like infections and autoimmune conditions and those sort of things. But chronic colitis in the long run can sometimes cause some damage to the walls of the bowel. And in the long run, there is a risk sometimes of premalignant change. But of course, all these things is in the context of the underlying pathology and the diagnosis of what it is. If your surgeon does think that a colonoscopy would be good in terms of monitoring and also to look out for things, I think that will be very much warranted. It's a very minimally invasive procedure. In terms of side effects of the procedure, it's actually not at a level that would be life-threatening. It is something tolerable. In overseas countries and in countries where colonoscopies are actually standard of care for even screening or even diagnosing patients with symptoms, a colonoscopy would be something that would be considered rather basic assessment. So in the context of colitis, if it is long-standing, I would definitely think that monitoring with a colonoscopy would be indicated.
And Zaidi, if you are like me who thinks that a colonoscopy is going to be terribly uncomfortable, I hear you can be sedated now.
Oh,
and
yes,
you probably
can.
Won't know what's going on. How wonderful is that? So, you know, I'm a lot more open to doing a colonoscopy for screening at the moment. So from your vantage point, what have been some of the noticeable advancements in therapies for cancer over the last few decades?
So when we talk about treatment for cancer patients, I think there's been so much of advancements that sometimes even we as oncologists find it hard to keep up to.
Yes.
When we sometimes attend some, especially international conferences, it's overwhelming.
How do you keep up with it?
I think you need to be constantly reading. You need to be constantly looking out for things. Sometimes patients know much more than you because they've been reading so much about the most recent thing that has come out. The thing about oncology is that it's one of those fields in medicine where the advancements has been so intense. It's one of the fields that is the most rapidly progressing in terms of pharmaceuticals, therapeutic options, as well as screening awareness and even research, translational medicine and all these fields. So being in this field, I think it is one of those fields. We even tell our juniors and even junior doctors who are keen to do this field that once you qualify, that's where your journey starts.
And that puts off
a lot of people because they think that, oh, once I'm done with my postgraduate studies, I'm supposed to be done with all this reading. And I know I just start working after that.
Because when you start, you're 3 years behind already.
Oh, yes.
You know? Yeah, it's
and
so
in this
much,
field,
yeah.
Yes, the field just in the field of treatment with regards to drugs, with regards to how we treat with radiation, when embolization, the techniques are just moving at a pace that just to keep up with it, you really need to keep yourself on your shoes and, you know, moving forward. So I think it's a field that is extremely interesting. It's a field that has progressed so much. And the best part about it is that you see how these advancements have actually translated to a difference in outcome. And that's what I think makes it extremely fulfilling because you know it is worthwhile. So the amount of time and attention that you pay to this will translate to a difference in how your patients fare, not only in terms of how long they survive, it's also in terms of their quality of life and how their symptoms are improved and, you know, how things go on after that. So when we talk about advancements, I think in chemotherapies, of course, were the very old, good old traditional drugs which came along in the 1950s and 60s.
It's almost become a bad word, actually.
Exactly. But I must say that in several types of cancers which we treat, like testicular cancers and germ cell tumors, relatively rarer tumors compared to the more common lung and breast and colon cancers, chemotherapy still forms a standard of care. So of course, we've got a lot of advancements with targeted therapies, immunotherapies, antibody treatments, cancer vaccines, all these newer agents. But I must say that, yes, their outcomes are pretty good. But in certain areas of cancer treatment, good old chemotherapy still does wonders at times. And I must say that the advancements in supportive treatment, meaning treatment and drugs that actually help counter the side effects of chemotherapy, have also advanced just almost as fast as the pace of our targeted therapies and immunotherapies. And so in this day and age, even patients who go through chemotherapy for whatever reason, will still have side effects, which I think far more tolerable compared to what it was before. So I think many would have heard of stories of people who went through chemo and vomited their days away and, you know, were extremely lethargic and couldn't walk after that. And I think that's a very real understanding of general population, because in the early days, of course, we did see that quite a bit. But I must say, in this day and age, in the last 10 years at least, patients shouldn't be having toxicities to that level unless their management in terms of the supportive treatment is not up to par with the actual treatment that they're going on.
Okay.
So in this day and age, when we counsel patients for treatment, we do tell them about these potential side effects, but we know that with treatment for these side effects, it's likely not going to be to a level that they're going to suffer through it.
And will this be sort of population-wide, or is this just dependent on the comfort levels or that you will get? Depends on your socioeconomic status, because, you know, so let's just say government versus the private sector, for an example. Will government be able to provide the better quality chemotherapy and options to manage the side effects and all of that? Or is it something that only if I'm able to pay for, will be able to, you know, benefit from?
Yep. So I do have got experience working in the government sector as well. So I must say that I think the advancements in drugs which have come along in the market versus what is available in the government sector is actually almost on par. So in terms of treatment, which are essential in terms of life-saving drugs and drugs which improve quality of life, definitely I would say in the government sector is to a level that is comparable. Of course, when it comes to newer agents like targeted therapies and immunotherapies, which are extremely expensive, I think most people are quite aware of the cost implications.
That's
of
all more like designer stuff,
right? So you can have fancy treatment and you can have essential treatment. Does fancy treatment equate to better outcome? Sometimes, but not all the time. So I think patients need to be aware that it does not always mean that if the treatment is expensive and the latest, that the outcome is going to be the best ultimately. So for people in this field, in oncology, of course, the doctors and people practicing in this field are very much aware of that, that fancy treatment does not always equate to the best outcomes. But yes, sometimes toxicity-wise, it's better. Outcome-wise, it's better. But whether it matches to the value-based medicine effect of it. So for treatment which is already reimbursed by the government, it's free for all, almost free. I wouldn't say zero ringgit, but it's extremely minimal charges. So you can have chemotherapies which cost a few thousand ringgit, where the patient is paying $50, even though they are not a government servant, which in the private sector might be several thousand dollars per cycle. So in cancer treatment, having chemotherapy or even targeted therapies or immunotherapies, which are five figures per cycle, is not something totally out of the norm. It can happen. But I would say that, of course, there are some treatments which really make a very big difference in outcome, and there are some which are marginal difference in outcome. Toxicity-wise, may be better, but in terms of long-term outcomes, it's actually sometimes marginal. So being in this field, I think as an oncologist, we have this responsibility of discussing it with our patients to make sure they understand that this is the kind of outcome that we are looking here. Because I think it's, of course, general perception that things which are very expensive will always be better.
Well, guilty as can be. That has always been my understanding. So thank you very much. And you said something so interesting, which we'll come back and explore a little bit more. You said something about value-based medicine. What's that in accounting terms? ROI, is it?
Not really
return on investment.
Investments. Okay. So value-based medicine is a very big concept in the field of medicine in general.
We'll come back and find
out.
Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. In the studio with me, Dr. Vaishnavi Jayasingham, consultant clinical oncologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center. We are discussing life-changing advancements in cancer care. If you have a question for her, give us a call. It's 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Okay, so you've gone through treatment options. Chemotherapy almost comes up as it's almost like the lifesaver. Everybody hates it. It's almost, as I said, the bad word in cancer that you don't want to hear. You have all sorts of fancy treatment, but it would feel like chemo still has its place as a backup for most forms of cancer treatment. It's interesting that you spoke about fancy versus essential treatment. Fancy perception is it is very expensive, and so outcomes would generally be better. However, that's not really the case all the time, as you have explained. So what I'm taking away is having that honest conversation with your oncologist about treatment options is extremely crucial, because it can be terribly costly as well. So the things to look out for, toxicity of it, the outcomes, what else do we look out for? Do we have to explore with our oncologists?
I think the main thing is to know that what is the ultimate outcome we are looking at here. So with early cancers, for most solid tumours like breast, lung, colon, common cancers, it's up to stage 3 disease, which is localised disease and it's not spread out from the primary where it started, is actually curative. When the disease has actually spread at the time of diagnosis, the treatment intent is what we say palliation. So palliation would mean trying to control and delay disease as much as we can and also to improve symptoms and quality of life in that process. But in that setting, the treatment is not curative in its nature. So sometimes, quite often, we see patients who are not aware that this treatment that they are going through is not of a curative intent. So usually with my patients, I do make it very clear the first time they come as well itself, because I think it's not fair to the patients to mislead them in a way that they think that all this treatment that they're actually going through is going to cure them at some point. We have good numbers of patients who are young, with young children. They are in their reproductive age of their lives. They are the sole breadwinners sometimes of their family. And I think they need to be aware of where this is heading, to have a really, really good understanding of if you're going to use up your finances or you're going to, you know, spend this much of time on your treatment, what is the likely outcome that we are looking at? And I think the biggest disappointment is sometimes when patients are not given that information or they misunderstand where this is heading. And on hindsight, years later, or months later, they realize that maybe this is not the best that they wanted for themselves. So I think it has to be an informed decision. In patients who are more educated and aware, it's easier to have this sort of a conversation because their level of understanding is quite different. Very often it is actually connected with the family dynamics as well. Of course, the cultural dynamics in our population is extremely important. Yes. We see a lot of patients, for instance, just breast cancer patients, ladies who are very reluctant to go through surgeries because their husbands are not that supportive, or family members who have a lot of things to say about this kind of treatment that they need to do. And unfortunately, somehow in our culture, we do see patients who feel the need to oblige and follow what others are saying rather than doing what they think is right for themselves. So we talked a little bit about chemotherapy as well as cancer treatment, but I would like to highlight that when it comes to curative treatment for cancer, the main modality that actually cures most early cancers is actually surgery. So in early breast cancers, early colon cancers, the common lung cancers, whatnot, surgery is likely what would cause the biggest impact in terms of cure when it's in a localized stage.
What have been some of the advancements in surgery?
So nowadays we do see a lot of treatment options with regards to surgery, which are becoming more and more minimally invasive, we see. Smaller scars, faster recovery, shorter hospital stays, advanced techniques with robotic surgeries, laparoscopic surgeries, treatment and surgeries which have become to a level that patients can go back to work sometimes within a week.
Wow.
Yes. So these are like really, really big options in surgery. So if just for instance, with breast cancer itself, breast conservation surgeries, where cosmetic-wise as well as outcome-wise, you don't see a difference sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to tell which side was operated because the cosmesis is so well done. The reconstruction advancements have really gone to a different level nowadays in our country, in the government as well as in the private sector. And I think in terms of surgical options, if surgeries are well done, nothing actually compares to that outcome that you will get compared to a surgery which is done in a manner which can be, you know, perfected better.
But even though with surgery, you still need the sort of treatment.
Yes. Chemotherapy comes in a lot of these cancers to eradicate, we say, microscopic cells if they have already gone into the bloodstream. So for patients with localized disease, following surgery in general, they will get chemotherapy basically to eradicate any cells which are left behind and hopefully reduce recurrence in the long run.
Okay.
Next to surgery, what I would like to say, the modality that actually cures the majority of our solid tumours is actually radiotherapy. So I think radiotherapy is an area which does not get that much attention sometimes compared to systemic treatment, we say like chemotherapy, immunotherapies and antibody treatment.
However, radiotherapy has this perception of being kinder than chemotherapy.
Oh yes, it does.
Is that correct?
I think it depends on the type of radiation and the cause of the radiation. So just to give an overview, radiotherapy actually can cure quite a good numbers of skin cancers, head and neck cancers like nasopharyngeal carcinomas, buccal carcinomas, oral cavity cancers, hypopharyngeal cancers, even cervical cancers. Cervix cancers are actually treated with radiotherapy. So these are modalities whereby even without surgery, radical radiation alone is actually a curative option. So in a lot of third world and middle income countries where governments are, you know, struggling to fund for their patients' treatment, investing in radiation is sometimes far better compared to investing in the chemotherapy or systemic treatment when you're looking at a curative approach to this treatment.
Okay. So it would seem like, you know, we have everything to benefit by getting diagnosed early. As much as we don't want to know, at least cost-wise as well, The earlier you get detected, the better for you, because it is a lot more affordable compared to getting diagnosed at a later stage, would you say?
I would say yes, but I must emphasize that I think in our government system, we do not have a national health insurance policy, yeah. which in my personal opinion is really a big disadvantage. But under our government healthcare system, I think a cost should never be a reason not to have treatment. So if patients have sought treatment in a place where the cost that was quoted to them was not something that they could afford, I really do not think that it would be a reason to choose alternative treatment or not have treatment at all, because in our government facilities, the treatment definitely can be done. There may be a little bit of a wait because of the volume of the patients seen in our cancer centres, but it is not to a level that they get denied treatment. So I hope that the general population does not get this perception that if they cannot afford it, hence they cannot have any treatment further.
Okay. Radiotherapy, you stopped at that. Is there anything else you want to bring to the fore as far as advancements is concerned?
So when it comes to radiation, we've seen a lot of advancements with regards to how radiotherapy is done nowadays. So toxicities of radiation in the past were pretty significant, although of course not to the level of chemotherapy. But with advancements in radiation with regards to how we do it now, basically the doses of radiation to the tumour nowadays is far higher than what we used to give in the past, mainly because we can actually constrain the organs surrounding the tumour to much lower doses of radiation. Hence, we actually see lower toxicities in the acute, meaning the short term, as well as in the long term as well. So radiation as a modality of cure, especially for even like nasopharyngeal cancer, something most of us are aware of, how even very popular people, sportsmen, have been diagnosed with nasopharyngeal cancer. And radiation actually cures these patients. So and nowadays, we know that in these patients who are survivors, their long-term sequelae is actually very minimal. Toxicity-wise, it's manageable. In patients, for instance, with lymphomas, young patients in their teenage and in middle age who would get diagnosed with lymphomas, radiating them in the past was associated with secondary malignancies, we say. So for instance, women who had lymphomas in their chest and were radiated with all radiation techniques, because of the minimal radiation dose that scatters to their breast and thyroid, there was this 5 to 10% rate of breast cancers and thyroid cancers in these lymphoma survivors. So of course, there were clinics which monitor these patients on a yearly basis for secondary malignancies and whatnot. But with modern techniques of radiation, which have been around even in Malaysia for the last 15, 20 years, even in the government setting, we do not really see this anymore, because we now know that we can minimize the doses of radiation to the normal structures, and hence toxicity is to a level that is negligible.
Okay, so we've spoken about targeted therapies, we've spoken about immunotherapy, which are, you know, treatment options, which I would say fancy, would you say, as you described?
I would say that certain types of immunotherapies have actually shown marked improvement in outcomes, for instance, in melanomas, which is a type of skin cancer, where the outcome of immunotherapies has been shown to be far better than chemotherapy. In certain types of tumours like gastrointestinal stromal tumours, GIST tumours, where targeted therapies called imatinib or Gleevec has shown outcomes of almost a 70% 5-year survival compared to 20 to 30% in the past with chemotherapy. So I think there have been quite a few tumours where the outcome has been far better, but I wouldn't say it's fair to have a blanket rule that all immunotherapies and targeted therapies will give you outcomes that are way beyond what it used to be.
See, that was my perception. Thanks very much for bringing me back to reality. Okay, so there, immunotherapy and all of that. Okay, let's look at diagnostic methods. There are a few advancements in diagnostic methods. Would you want to go through those?
So I think the advancements in pathology with regards to how we do biopsies and diagnose these tumours has really advanced in the last decade, internationally as well as in our country. In the past, how we diagnose these tumours made a big difference in terms of how we treat them. So for instance, if you said lung cancer in the past, lung cancer in the 1960s was just lung cancer. And then it evolved into the different types of lung cancers where you have squamous cells and adenocarcinomas and large cells. What we are looking at in this day and age is the adenocarcinoma itself, which has another 7 or 8 subtypes. And based on each of these subtypes, we have targeted therapies which show outcomes which are better compared to the other or compared to chemotherapy as well. So in the past, if we had to do biopsies to get a chunk of tissue out to diagnose what it is, nowadays in certain types of tumours, it has moved on to liquid biopsies, we say. So for patients whose tumours are not accessible, difficult biopsies, tissues were not adequate or couldn't be diagnosed in that manner, taking a blood sample will sometimes diagnose these tumours. Yeah, so the facilities are actually available.
Just from a blood test?
Yes, for certain types of cancers. So for lung cancers, for instance, where we call this EGFR mutation test for lung cancers. So liquid biopsies are very well established nowadays. It wouldn't be to a level that it replaces the role of tissue biopsy, but definitely an option in patients whose tissues are inadequate, deep-seated tumors where biopsies have been difficult. Sometimes patients had complications when they had sedations or when they went in for procedures. So it can be something that is minimally invasive, and the facilities are definitely available.
And what about false positives and false negatives?
So every test has got false positives and false negatives. It has to be weighed in the background of the results that you get. Of course, tissue biopsies have shown sensitivities and specificities which are actually higher than tissue biopsies. But I would say the rates are comparable. So I think tissue biopsies would be in the context of a tissue diagnosis, which is not possible. But the sensitivity of the tissue biopsies is actually to a level that diagnosis can be established and treatment can actually be initiated based on that itself.
Okay. What is significant in your mind when it comes to diagnosis? Diagnostic methods and which sort of cancers have sort of benefited the most?
I think when it comes to the common solid tumours that we have, I think it's in the field of lung cancers where diagnostic molecular profiling, we say, has advanced to a level that treatment, it has actually caused a big impact in how we treat these cancers. So to me, of course, diagnosing it is one thing, but whether we have a therapeutic option at the end of it is the one that ultimately makes the difference to the patient as well as to the treating physician. Breast cancers have advanced. In the past, we said it was a hormone positive or a hormone negative breast cancer. But in this day and age, we've got further profiling which has gone into therapeutic options, which have of course made a difference in terms of how we treat these patients and their outcomes in the long run.
As well.
Yes,
okay.
Definitely.
All right. And what about screening, Dr. Vaishnavi? Anything, groundbreaking in the screening side? I mean, I think we should work more on that so we can, sort of
definitely
avoid cancers altogether if we could.
I think a screening of good numbers of cancers are possible, but it's not 100% and it is not in all cancers. So when we talk about a good screening method, we look at tests which are relatively cheap because we want to screen general population, not only a certain subset of privileged population.
Yep.
So in that manner, that is not screening. That is very selective assessment.
Yep.
So when we talk about screening, it has to be something which is accessible to everyone and anyone. Cost should not be the limiting factor in any way. Access, cost, and everything should be to a level that it's equal to all. So a cheap, a very, very sensitive test would be the best. If you ask me, the gold standard example would be pap smears for cervical cancer. So cervical cancer is actually the second leading cause for death, cancer death among women. But unfortunately, it doesn't get the attention that breast cancer gets. Somehow, even in, cervical cancer is deemed to be something like a third world country kind of a cancer. It's far more common in African countries, India, countries where, socioeconomically, they're not as well off as the Western countries. So even in Malaysia, it's the second leading cause of death. But definitely, most people would agree that the level of awareness, understanding and promotion that we see with regards to cervical cancer is not to the level that what breast cancer gets. So pap smears are very simple tests. Reliability and access is extremely easy. Tests which have a pre-malignant state, which is very long. So if you do a pap smear this year and it is clear, you can be assured that you're not going to get cervical cancer in the next 2 to 3 years. So it's that kind of a reliability. So it's not a test that you need to do every 6 months or every 2 months to say that, maybe now it has become cancer. So there's a pre-malignant condition which lasts pretty long. So the likelihood of picking it up is really good. So as long as patients have gone for one, and there's nothing, usually the recommendation is only to repeat it maybe in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, depending on your risk factors and whatnot. And of course, we do know the advancements in vaccination for HPV.
Yep.
So nowadays, we do know that even in Malaysia, our girls are all vaccinated.
Yes, and it's the 10th year this year,
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes. So of course, initially, it was not 100% all school children were receiving it. But of course, we do know that now all our school children are getting free vaccination for HPV. In terms of other vaccines for cancer, I don't think it has been to the level of the success of HPV vaccination.
Okay. Yes. We'll come back after the market update and answer a question here about outcomes for those who refuse treatment to the end. Will they suffer more during the last days? I mean, this is a question I've asked myself. So fantastic, whoever sent that question through, coming up after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Ira Sivasuthi. If you have just joined us, it's our Health and Living segment. Dr. Vaishnavi Jayasingham, consultant clinical oncologist from Subang Jaya Medical Center, in the studio with me. We're discussing life-changing advancements in cancer care. Just before we jump into the other advancements, Dr. Vaishnavi, we have a question here about what would be the outcomes for those who refuse cancer treatment to the end. Will they suffer more during their last days?
I think my personal opinion would be that is totally a myth to think that if patients do not opt for modern medical care in hospital-based treatment, that they're likely going to be suffering far more than patients who opted not to. So the thing is that I think advancements in palliative care is one of those aspects that I was actually quite keen to talk about with regards to how we can improve patients' lives as well as their symptoms due to cancers. Like I mentioned earlier, patients with early cancers, of course, treatment options are curative. And in that setting, I think people need to, you know, weigh the options and the benefits as versus the risk in a far more serious manner, because we're looking at a curative option here. So when we're looking at curative treatment options like surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, hormonal therapy, targeted therapies and whatnot, and we know that the ultimate outcome is going to be a cure, I think that would influence many people's way of deciding of whether to go down this line of treatment. But having said that, I think ultimately it is always the choice of the patient. It is whichever direction this goes through, I think the patient has to be comfortable with the decision they have made. Feeling forced to go through treatment that they are not convinced with is, I think, one of those things which would be the most detrimental in terms of finding peace and getting to that level of acceptance of the diagnosis as well as living with cancer after that. So I very often tell my patients that never feel obliged because the neighbor or someone nearby is saying that no, you have to have treatment, or a family member is forcing you to have it. I think ultimately if patients are not convinced that this is the treatment that they want to go through, the way they tolerate treatment as well as the outcomes are, to me, very much influenced by this, because the morale as well as the emotional level is not at that level where we would see them benefiting from the treatment. Sometimes we have seen patients who go through treatment when they are not really in acceptance of these treatment options that they are going through, where although radiologically and clinically they seem to be improving, but it's not translating to a difference in their quality of life or even in their emotional state and how they are. And very often when you have a chat with them, sometimes they don't appreciate the fact that their disease is being controlled because they feel that this is not what they wanted for themselves.
Right.
So I really believe that patients need to make an informed consent. They need to think about it very seriously and be convinced that this is what they want for themselves, either way, whichever way the treatment goes. So it's not to say that all treatment will be successful all the time. Although success rates may be good, it doesn't mean that it's 100%. So although somebody is diagnosed with, say, a stage 1 disease where the cure rates, for instance, in breast cancer is 90% and above, it does not mean that everybody will be cured of that disease. They still need to be monitored. At some point, disease can relapse. Although the rates are not that high, we do know that I think no one can give that assurance that, yes, we are out and this is never going to come back again.
Yeah, it's your right, isn't it?
Obviously, definitely.
Because I always hear, you know, I've been diagnosed and, you know, I have to do surgery next week. Mm. And I'm thinking, have you had the chance to think about this and what the long-term plan is, you know, things like that. But in the context of cancer, Dr. Vaishnavi, can you actually use the word cure?
Yes, you can. I think in this day and age with early cancers, we do see good numbers of patients who are actually cured. Good surgeries at
early stage. Cure mean?
Cure would mean that a patient who is diagnosed with early disease and following curative treatment does not experience a relapse after that. So we've got long-term cancer survivor clinics where these are patients who had breast cancer 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So they're all long-term survivors. They may have relapsed with a nodule or a chest wall recurrence, which was still of curative intent. They went through surgery again. They did a bit more treatment and they are well. So they have not relapsed for a very, very significant duration of treatment. So usually we say with most cancers, the risk of relapse is the highest within the first 2 years, depending on the type of cancers, but in general. So if they've passed a five-year mark after having diagnosed with early stage cancer, we still don't tell them that this is 100% cure, but we are looking at someone who will likely not relapse after this. But of course, again, it's never a never. Patients still need to be monitored. So cancer patients are usually never discharged. They will be at least sent to the primary surgeon or someone who will monitor these patients. There will never be a situation where they say that, yes, we are totally out of the woods and, you know, no form of monitoring is needed after this. So I think for patients with early stage disease, having a cure with no relapse is definitely a clear possibility in this day and age. I don't think it's in a situation where we are looking at a lot of young or even early stage patients who are having stage 4 disease ultimately. Yep.
So another reason why you should be diagnosed early, isn't it?
Yes.
You spoke about younger people nowadays getting diagnosed with cancer. We know, you know, testicular cancer, for an example, we've always known that younger men are more prone to testicular cancer. However, there are younger people, even females and males, being diagnosed with cancer at much younger age. And with testicular cancer in particular, I know we've spoken about fertility preservation, but what about in other sorts of cancers as well? And what are the options for fertility preservation?
Okay, so fertility preservation among cancer patients is actually a huge, huge topic in medicine. So what we are looking at now is actually minimizing treatment, which can actually affect fertility in the long run. So what is happening nowadays is for patients who are younger, who are in their reproductive age, patients who have not completed their families yet, options of preserving their fertility and minimizing fertility, infertility in the long run are being looked at. So for instance, in men, where we do know that certain types, it's not all chemotherapy, but certain types of treatment can actually cause infertility in the long run. So for men, options of sperm banking prior to starting treatment, where the sperms are actually stored. And if at all there comes a need to use it later on, it is available for in vitro fertilization or other forms of assisted conception. But I must say that not every patient who goes through treatment will end up with infertility, but the percentages are definitely there depending on the type of treatment that they went through. With women, it's a little bit more complicated because the ovaries are deep-seated and the ovums produce in a monthly basis.
And you just can't produce that ovary and say, that egg and say, take.
Release it and say, have it.
Yeah. Anytime for the man, you can just give up whatever you have.
Okay, so fertility-preserving options for our young female patients, there are actually multiple options of treatment. Of course, nowadays for patients like young breast cancer patients who are in their 20s and 30s, we actually do give them hormones, which actually so-called protect their ovaries. So we are hoping that during the multiple cycles of chemotherapy, the eggs are not released from the ovums that cause damage to the reserve eggs which are existing. So we are hoping that the younger patients will not lose the majority of their reserved eggs, so that hopefully after they finish treatment later, and these are patients whom we are aiming for cure, will be able to have a spontaneous conception or at least an assisted conception, meaning that they at least have some reserve eggs which can be matured later and moved on. In patients with cervical cancers, for instance, early tumours, nowadays there are many operative options where they do very minimal surgeries which can still conserve the uterus. Surgeries which do not cause cervical incompetence. So here, whereby if they do conceive later, they do not end up with recurrent abortions and things like that. So minimally invasive surgeries, which hopefully outcomes are not worse off than definitive surgeries, but do have good outcomes in the long run. Cryopreservation of ovarian tissue, a laparoscopic surgery where they remove part of the ovarian tissue and they freeze it. And this frozen ovarian tissue is actually kept for future use. So I know some patients find it hard to understand that. How can you freeze this for so long and take it out later and expect it to be functioning?
But because this is not the egg, right? This is
the ovarian tissue where the eggs are actually produced from the ovarian tissue. So it's actually very remarkable advancements in the field of medicine, which I think makes a very big difference to patients. The fact of being diagnosed with cancer when they were younger and later to actually have a child and go on with family life is, I think, something that would be the most life-changing in a patient's perception. Not even the fact that they survived, but the fact that they managed to conceive a child and their progeny continued after that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I used to think breast reconstruction was a huge development because of, you know, the way the woman feels, you know, with her breasts. But this is just amazing, especially that, you know, people have cancer younger and younger today. So there is all of this available to you. It's always good to know, isn't it? It's so consoling. Let's talk about cutting-edge therapies and the lack of awareness. Which do you think we should be focusing on? Because, as I said, cutting-edge therapies may not be accessible to everyone. And if awareness doesn't move in tandem with that, what difference is it going to make to us as a population?
I think to us as a population, to have that difference in outcome, it has to reach to the mass. So what we do see in Malaysia is that we do not have a national health insurance policy. So there's a big discrepancy with regards to cancer treatment funding. I think the issue here is actually mainly funding. So under our healthcare policy in our government, of course, you pay $1 and you can see a doctor in a health clinic.
Yeah.
If you pay $5, you see a specialist in a government hospital. Of course, minus the crowd and the, you know, a bit of chaos sometimes.
Inconvenience, yep.
Yes,
yep.
I think we need to acknowledge that. I think everyone who has stepped into a government hospital would at some point may have experienced that. But things are improving and things are changing. But under the government healthcare policies, we know that cost is never a barrier. In terms of the treatment which is available and is provided by the government, cost will not come in as an issue. But if it is treatment which is fairly new, state of art, those sort of things, and it is yet to be in the government formulary in terms of drugs or even radiation techniques, then there is a bit of a cost implication that comes in. In private hospitals, we do know that cost is borne by the patient, either through insurance or paying out of pocket. So when it comes to this kind of treatment where, of course, the hospitals need to pay for their facilities and, of course, maintenance of this treatment is extremely expensive. So we end up with this situation that patients need to fund for this treatment. So ultimately, for patients who do not have insurance or self-funding, they end up with the situation where they feel troubled by the fact that they want to have certain type of treatment, but they are unable to pay for it. But ultimately, I think it does boil down to, I think, our government having the need to plan in the long run. So I think there has to be some form of policy or thing that ultimately every patient would get above average care, whether they step into a government facility or even a private facility. In my experience of working overseas before, of course, they've got national health insurance policies. General people do pay a national insurance premium, and it's, of course, prorated with their actual income. But at the end of the day, I think the fact that anyone who steps into a private or a government facility is going to get that above average care is something that I think was really remarkable. And to me, that was really something that I thought it would make a big difference in the long run.
And which is why we need to push for a national healthcare financing scheme. We need it. I mean, we can't go on like this for any longer.
The government healthcare system, I don't think it can sustain for very long like this.
Not at one ringgit and 5 ringgit.
Exactly.
Nuh-uh. Okay. You know, would you have a message for us on life-changing advancements in cancer care?
With regards to, I think, patients who are diagnosed with cancers, I think the thing that we want, I would like to say is that it can strike anyone. I think one of the most common questions that I get from patients is, why me?
Yeah.
I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't lie. You know, but and why is it me? So I don't have an answer for that as well. Of course, we do say that certain lifestyle does predispose people towards cancer, but it doesn't mean that every single person who smokes gets cancer in their lifetime. We do see patients whose husbands are smokers, but the wives are the ones with the cancer as secondary passive smokers. Yeah. But the husbands are fine. So it's multifactorial, it's genetical, it's environmental. I think the reason for why cancer is there, nowadays sometimes I tell patients, I think it's maybe fate. I know, you just can't explain it sometimes. But the thing that I would like to say is that there's a lot of emphasis on cancer survivorship. And sometimes when we see support groups and whatnot, there are many cancer survivors as well as people who, the definition of surviving is, I think, very, very subjective in my opinion. Having disease that is cured, but not being at peace with the diagnosis and not being able to sleep at night even, of constantly having that worry that whether this disease may come back. And you know, in my personal opinion, I wouldn't say that would be survivorship at its best. Although the disease is cured, but to have that mental and emotional state of acceptance and being able to be at peace with all this, is to me, that is a survivor at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that patients who eventually succumbed to their illness, mainly because they had disease which was far more aggressive due to whatever reason. We see a lot of patients who are very young who have done everything they could. They've sometimes even used up their savings, they've sold their car, they've done all sorts of things for the best so-called treatment that they could get. And somehow eventually they still do recur or get stage 4 disease. But that wouldn't mean that they are not the survivor. Because to me, ultimately, the person who is at peace with all that is going on and can actually achieve that level of acceptance is the ultimate survivor, irrespective of how long they have survived with this disease.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank Dr. Vaishnavi Jayasingham, consultant clinical oncologist from Subangjaya Medical Center, speaking to us about life-changing advancements in cancer care on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.